from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, we are here in a moment of unity in our state, without ill will, to say it's time to move the flag from the Capitol grounds.
That was South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley as she called for the removal of the Stars and Bars, as it's called, the Confederate flag, from her state's statehouse grounds. That call comes in the wake of last week's terrorist attack on the historic Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, allegedly by a white supremacist who killed 9 black members of the congregation. We'll have more on that later in this newscast. The Syrian conflict shows no sign of stopping while terrible human rights abuses continue unabated, that according to UN investigators Tuesday. More than 5 years into the conflict, the UN investigator who heads a UN probe into the war, Paolo Pinheiro, said before the UN Human Rights Council that the situation is, quote, a profound failure, closed quote, by the international community. Pinheiro accused government and rebel forces of what he called, quote, seemingly deliberate, closed quote, decisions to put civilians in harm's way. We begin with this report from Daniel Johnson at the UN in Geneva.
The violence and targeting of civilians has become so awful in Syria that just buying bread has become a life and death decision. That's what Paolo Pinheiro, chief investigator of human rights abuses in the Syrian conflict, told the UN Human Rights Council on Tuesday. In his latest report on the fighting, Pinheiro condemned both government and rebel forces. He focused on indiscriminate shelling and siege warfare tactics, which forced civilians to bear the brunt of the fighting. And he said that recent reports on the use of chlorine gas during attacks on towns in northeast Idlib governorate are under investigation. In the meantime, no one is spared from the suffering which knows no agenda, ethnicity or religion, Pinheiro said. In fact, targeting civilians appears to be a key tactic.
In no instance have the parties to the conflict show any commitment to the paramount obligation under international law to distinguish between civilian and military objectives.
On the Syrian government side, the UN investigator detailed its relentless bombardment of areas sheltering armed groups, which included using barrel bombs. The result was death and displacement, mainly of women and children, as young men over 15 years old were likely to be detained at checkpoints. Rebel fighters, including ISIS and al-Nusra, meanwhile, had terrorized men, women and children just to show the government that they are still a force to be reckoned with. The UN investigator also condemned the siege tactics used by the warring parties, which is forbidden in international law. In Yarmouk camp in Damascus, Pinheiro said 40% of children suffer from malnutrition because of the government's surrender or starve tactics. Those forced to stay in what's left of Yarmouk eat domestic animals or leaves to survive. As for the rebel fighters, their strategy of besieging cities has left people dying of starvation. The situation is desperate in and around Idlib, where there are dire shortages of food, medicine and baby milk. Now in its 5th year, the fighting has killed more than 220,000 people, according to UN figures. The stalemate on the ground and at an international level needs to be broken, Pinheiro told the Human Rights Council.
The continuing war represents a profound failure of diplomacy. Influential states have acted with equivocation in their efforts to extinguish the conflict in Syria, believing that military pressure is a prerequisite for any political process to succeed. External actors have flooded the warring parties they support with money, fighters and weapons.
The UN investigator said that states needed to realize that without a resolution of the conflict in Syria, the whole world will suffer the consequences. But he warned that none of the warring parties believed they would ever have to answer for their actions, so they had little incentive to stop fighting. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
Syria's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Hussam Edin Ayla, answered on behalf of Damascus.
Shukran, Sayyidina.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, during the period under review, taken by the COI, the inhabited areas in Damascus and Aleppo have been subject to scores of rockets of those who some might like to call as moderate opposition. These are attacks that caused the deaths of civilians, women and children. At the same, during the same period, the villages of Ishtabrak and Qalb Lozeh have been the subject of attack by terrorists of the Al-Nusra Front, supported by Turkey, while the twin terrorist organization of ISIS has committed massacres in Palmyra, as well as caused the death, abduction, and injury of hundreds of people. However, these crimes and massacres don't seem to have found their way to the report of the COI, in spite of the fact that our commission in our official letters have sent them to the OHCHR and to the HRC. This willful neglect of the information provided by Syria to the international bodies about the practices of these terrorist organization proves the determination to follow through the methodology implemented since 4 years by the COI, which is to base themselves on tarnished, fabricated information, which aims at tarnishing the image of Syria and the international community. And, Mr. President, the accusation leveled against the Syrian government in the report by deliberately targeting the civilians and civilian institutions such as schools and hospitals, and impeding the delivery of humanitarian assistance and targeting archaeological sites. These are accusations with the political motivations, and they are refuted by the logic. I should like to refer to the following points. The committee that based itself on the IHL in order to attack and accuse the government of Syria ignored other IHL provisions that prohibit the armed groups from entrenching themselves in civilian areas and use human people as humanitarian shields. I should like in this context to refer to the reports of the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights While Countering Terrorism, that the armed groups have entrenched themselves within civilian areas and took people as human shields. Secondly, the organized terrorist groups have used the schools and hospitals as detention places and arrests, and this is documented in our side and by the United Nations. However, this is being ignored. The Syrian government is making every effort in order to provide the basic needs of its people in a very difficult situation, which is targeting the destruction of the infrastructures and civil services by the organized terrorist group. However, the Special Rapporteur on IDPs saw the immense effort deployed by the Syrian government during his last visit to Syria. It is noticeable that the committee continues to not pay attention to the unilateral coercive measures that are affecting the living situation of the Syrian citizens. Fourthly, contrary to what was mentioned in the report regarding the Al-Yarmouk camp, the Syrian government, in cooperation with UNRWA and the Red Crescent, have managed to remove more than 10,000 civilians from the camp and provided them nearby shelters as well as all their needs. And we have more than 1,000 people that we are helping inside the camp. Fifthly, it's deplorable that the report omitted the attacks against archaeological sites by Islam Army and Al-Nusra Front, who have also attacked the old city of Aleppo by digging tunnels under the archaeological sites and blasting them. Mr. President, the Turkish media has published a short video on the involvement of Erdogan's regime by sending weapons to al-Nusra inside trucks supposedly carrying humanitarian assistance. Other truck drivers confessed to smuggling ISIS terrorists inside Syria. This proves Turkey's involvement in the, supporting terrorism. The committee's report, while it admitted the role played by a country countries known for their support of terrorism in Syria and their responsibility in escalating the situation on the ground, it's abstinent from naming these countries. This is a responsibility of the committee and its head, because they are covering the collusion of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Jordan and others in shedding the blood of Syrians from the operation rooms in Turkey and in Jordan. In conclusion, the continued biased position of the CIA against Syria is deplorable. Therefore, we believe that this position of collusion and biased position against the Syrian government leads us to reject the reports of the committee. Thank you.
Russia's representative, Alexei Usluyin, called for an end to outside interference in Syria as a necessary precondition to a political settlement.
President, the situation in Syria gives rise to growing concern. This is no longer a matter merely of war and victims, but the preservation of the Syrian state. The terrorist threat has acquired menacing proportions. This is demonstrated in the Commission's report. Jihadists are committing barbaric crimes and destroying cultural and religious sites. There is persecution of Christians and other religious and ethnic groups. There is also a grave situation of Ismailites and Shiites that are besieged in Fur and Karfaya and are surviving exclusively thanks to humanitarian support dropped by Syrian Air Force helicopters. The activities of the so-called anti-ISIL coalition is not bearing fruit, and civilian losses as a result of these bombings, according to the data of a number of NGOs, are growing. Is it not time for the Commission to turn its attention to this? The scale and focus of Islamic State's activities is unprecedented. Whereas Al-Qaeda committed attacks to sow horror, Islamic State uses terrorism as a way to achieve the ambitious aim of building a caliphate, where there will be no place for democracy and where the very concept of human rights will be destroyed. In these conditions, we call upon the Commission, in the spirit of genuine independence, to pay continued attention to the activities of terrorists from IS, Jabhat al-Nusra and other groups. We repeat our request to prepare a report on the crimes committed by jihadists from Jabhat al-Nusra. We are worried by info in the Commission's report that terrorists continue to receive support from outside. Countries which, in violation of Security Council resolutions, are providing direct or indirect support with a view to destroying Syrian statehood, bear responsibility for this ongoing bloodshed. We took note of the assertion that support for the so-called moderate groups has given rise to a growth in terrorist activity in Syria. It is through this lens that we should see attempts to create new armed groups of the Syrian opposition and then subsequently introduce them into Syria, chiefly as part of the train and equip program. Experience shows that sooner or later, weapons delivered to these moderate opposition figures will end up in the hands of ISIL and other terrorist groups. We note, like the Commission, that the recent victories of militants has largely been possible due to close coordination between moderate armed groups and radicals from Jabhat al-Nusra. President, we agree with the Commission that there is no alternative to a political diplomatic solution to the Syrian crisis. The Syrians themselves, without dictates from outside, should determine their future. Russia will continue to support creating the conditions for a fully-fledged inter-Syrian political process, and we are prepared, if necessary, to continue the practice of holding consultations in Moscow between representatives of Damascus and a wide range of opposition groups. We recall that it was in Moscow that, for the first time in 4 years of conflict, there was agreement on a common inter-Syrian platform. We support the efforts of UN Special Envoy Stefan de Mistura on finding a solution to the crisis. Thank you for your attention.
The meeting on the war in Syria came as leaked documents from the files of senior Saudi officials revealed that Saudi Arabia took an active role in attempting to unite the Syrian opposition that is trying to topple the government in Damascus, with guidance provided by France. The role of France in directing Saudi involvement was disclosed in one of the documents released by the Yemen Cyber Army after it hacked the Saudi foreign ministry in May. The leaked documents show that France had, on at least two occasions, urged the Saudi rulers to promise to respect the rights of religious and ethnic minorities to draw their support away from the Damascus government. Other released documents disclosed that Saudi Arabia sent an envoy to the Vatican in 2012 to meet the Vatican foreign minister, Dominique Ramberti, to seek to convince the Pope to throw his weight behind the anti-government fighters by promising that, if they took power, they would not massacre other minorities in Syria. The promise was made by Riyadh on behalf of the insurgents. Later events showed that the Saudi-backed insurgents have killed all minorities, Muslim and non-Muslim, in the territories that they've occupied in both Syria and Iraq. According to the leaked documents, the Vatican politely disregarded the Saudi envoys sought after support for the Syrian opposition.
I am pleased to announce, and I discussed with my colleagues earlier today, that we will temporarily stage one armored brigade combat team's vehicles and associated equipment in countries in Central and Eastern Europe.
That was U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter Tuesday, as he announced that the U.S. will move more tanks, artillery, and other military equipment into Eastern and Central Europe. Carter said the Baltic states of Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, as well as Bulgaria, Romania, and Poland, agreed to host some of the heavy equipment and that some would also be deployed in Germany. Lithuania's foreign minister welcomed the move but said more needed to be done. Lithuania's government has already reinstated military conscription. The announcement came a day after the twin anniversaries of Hitler's invasion of the Soviet Union on June 22, 1941, and a pro-Nazi uprising on that same date in Lithuania. It also came a day after Russia's President Vladimir Putin had told French President François Hollande and German Chancellor Angela Merkel in a phone conversation Monday that Ukrainian forces must stop shelling in eastern Ukraine immediately. The Kremlin said that conversation took place ahead of a meeting of foreign ministers from Russia, Germany, France, and Ukraine scheduled for Tuesday. President Obama's fast-track authority on the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, treaty appears itself to be on a fast track after a Senate closure vote Tuesday to end debate on legislation granting the president enhanced negotiating powers to complete the deal was held. The Senate voted 60-37 Tuesday to advance the Trade Promotion Authority legislation, which will now go up for a vote in Congress. That vote could come as soon as Friday. South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley called Tuesday for the removal of the Civil War-era Confederate flag from statehouse grounds. That call was made in the wake of last week's terrorist attack on the historic Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, allegedly by a white supremacist, which killed 9 black members of the congregation. At her side during the announcement were Senator Lindsey Graham, who earlier this month announced a bid for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination, and the state's other senator, Tim Scott. At the announcement of his presidential bid, Graham said that his fear that the world is, quote, exploding in terror and violence, close quote, inspired him to make the run for the White House. Neither Graham nor Scott spoke at Governor Haley's announcement Tuesday, although CNN reported that their sources earlier in the day said the pair had endorsed her decision. Only the state legislature in South Carolina may remove the flag, according to a deal made when it was moved in 2000 off the Capitol's dome to the memorial where it now stands. A vote on that could take place this week. Haley said she would use her power to call an emergency session if the legislators failed to act on their own. The shockwaves of the massacre at the historic church continue to reverberate around the U.S. Glenn Ford, senior editor at BlackAgendaReport.com, spoke with Kevin Alexander Gray, activist and writer based in Columbia, South Carolina, which is located near the home of the alleged murderer of the 9 members of the church's congregation, Dylan Roof.
Lexington County, the most conservative Republican county in the state. Headquarters of Maurice Bessinger's barbecue. Now, Maurice is dead, and they ain't flying the Confederate flag over his barbecue outfit anymore. But if you go out into Pelion and Gaston and Swansea and all those little small towns out in rural Lexington County, I mean, you know, you'll see Confederate flags flying all over the place. And, you know, for the most part, here in South Carolina, a Confederate flag on a car, bump of a car, is just as common as a stop sign.
Ford also spoke with Reverend Anthony Evans, president of the National Black Church Initiative, a coalition of 34,000 African-American and Latino churches in the U.S. working to eradicate racial disparity. Evans said that the number one issue facing black churches in the U.S. is security.
It is no question that this is an assault against the black church and its members. I want to point out very clear evidence that will back this up. First of all, this was a community-based pastor. He was just not a local pastor, but he was a state representative. He was constantly in the news. That's number one. Number two, he spoke out very forcefully and clearly and powerfully against the police officer who was charged with murder of Mr. Walter Scott of the North Charleston Police Department. Number three, he called for body cameras on a state level that all police should have. So he was constantly in the news. So the only thing that Mr. Roof had to do is Google his name and find out who is the church. And then he would have gotten two for the price of one, because that was the most historic, oldest church in South Carolina. And so he systematically planned this attack. He knew that he would came on a Sunday, he would have got some resistance. But he came on a Wednesday night, which is prayer meeting and Bible study night, and he blended in a small crowd, sat in the back, and everybody thought that he just came for prayer and understanding the scripture, but he came to murder. Now, the question for us to investigate is that who motivated him to do this? Because we do not believe that he acted on his own, that there are forces within South Carolina and this country that galvanize young white males to do these mass murders. And no one has done the story, Glenn, on the fact that why is it that white males keep doing these atrocities? There is something wrong with their psychology. Connecticut, that white boy killed 23 babies. In Colorado, all of those are white kids who mass murdered on two occasions, who mass murdered one under the Clinton administration, now under this administration. And also here is another case of point. Why is it that white kids with guns who hate black people under 21 is running around murdering black people in a systematic way? This is an assassination.
And yet President Obama came on national television and he seemed to be saying that this is about gun violence, and he made no mention of race.
Well, the president has gotten this wrong from the beginning because he's afraid of race. He's black, but he's afraid of race. Let's go down the situation. He called the looters, the folks who were protesting in Baltimore, particularly the ones who burned the CVS, as thugs. But he didn't call the white kids, the white men, white gang in Colorado, the Midwest, who killed nine, which police gathered over 200 weapons, automatic weapons, AK-47s and others. They confiscated over 200 bikes and arrested over 150 white men. But he didn't say anything about them being a thug. And neither did the president say anything about this young man who murdered innocent black Christians who were praying to Jesus, harmless, that he was a thug. He systematically walked in, assassinated the pastor, and killed everybody else in sight. And he thought he had mercy by sparing the life of one or several black women who they to go out and report what he has done.
And you're preparing to go to South Carolina to direct a number of churches on security measures that they should undertake for their congregants and their families.
Again, the lack of leadership from the administration. This is not the first time that violence has happened in a black church. Violence has gone up in particularly the black church by 700% over the past 10 years and has gone up the same amount of rate in the white church. The administration has never said anything about working with us pastors to mitigate that situation in any way, have shown no leadership skills whatsoever, have been afraid to even touch this issue, and I don't know why. And it seems to me that, again, this administration, this president, gets it wrong every single time when it comes down to race, when it comes down to killing, when it comes down to the church. I'm not sure what to say other than the fact that we continue to pray for our president, and we continue to pray for this country, but prayers won't do it this time. We need some action, and that's why I'm going down personally to direct our churches how to harden their church in terms of safety of men, women, and children, and women, to make sure that they can get through a worship series without getting killed. They do not have to worry about this in the white church. We only have to worry about this in the black church. I question why. Why is there no leadership from this administration? The Justice Department is toothless, and they have no power whatsoever. It's the same Justice Department that we suffered under J. Edgar Hoover. This is unbelievable that we're revisiting this type of history all over again.
Sounds like you might be talking about reviving Deacons for Self-Defense, which has a venerable tradition.
Well, we're going to have to revive that, but let's be very clear that we're not talking about violence. We're talking about preventing violence. We're talking about protecting the church, which we have a moral and religious right to do, and we are not talking about guns. We're talking about putting in place safety measures that will clearly undergird whatever security at those churches now that I know that is none, and also make people conscious that they are soft targets. This has been known by the administration for years, given the fact of what has continued to happen in the Middle East, how on an arbitrary basis, how extreme Islamic brothers and sisters, how they blow up the mosque. I mean, this is nothing new, but the administration under George Bush and under Obama has done nothing to protect the church, has done nothing to provide training, has done nothing to provide a brochure, has done nothing to provide anything. He just allow us to be sitting ducks. We will not be sitting ducks. We will protect our worshipers.
Yes, there is nothing new about attacking black churches, especially down south. And there's nothing new about these armed white supremacist groups either.
And the FBI and the ATF seem toothless and powerless to stop them. They are not committed in protecting us against the extremists, not from the extremist Muslims, but from the extremists right in our communities, right in the United States. We're being terrorized in the face of all of this, and we're getting no protection from the federal government.
You've had preliminary talks, I'm sure, with other reverends and congregations in South Carolina. What's their reaction?
Well, their reaction is the same as mine. They want to harden security around the church. They want to protect the parishioners. Now that the authorities have taken note to the fact that they are soft target, but this is, again, this is nothing new. The black church has been bombed, terrorized for 400 years. But if this would happen to a Jewish mosque, we'll see everybody so upset. But this is not happening to Jewish people. This is happening to black folk. And yet our president cannot fix his lips to say that this is a racial motivated crime visited only on black people on a barbaric level, and this young man need to be dealt with accordingly. And I have to say as a clergy that may God have mercy on his soul.
And we close with this commentary from imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Charleston, a young white man, barely at the age of his majority, walks into Charleston's most storied black church, and before he leaves, a new history is written. Attending a Wednesday night Bible study, he sits for nearly an hour, but his mind isn't on the life of Jesus nor his disciples. It's on murder, mass murder. When the door shuts behind him, 9 black souls, elders mostly, had been slain, Bibles in hand. The man, more boy than man really, hadn't come to learn about religion, for he had a belief, white supremacy, or the profound hatred of black people. White supremacy is the mother's milk of Charleston, of South Carolina, of the South, of America. For surely as slavery funded and built America, the underlying principle was the devaluation, exploitation, and oppression of black life. It's the only thing that makes the church massacre in Charleston even remotely intelligible. 9 black people were sacrificed to the blind idol of white supremacy for the same reason that thousands of black men and women were lynched on American elms and pines, as sacrifices to an idea to perpetuate a system of economic injustice. Dylan Roof, the 21-year-old accused of this massacre, had no friends to speak of, no place to stay other than an associate's couch, no job, and a tenuous relationship with his parents. Isolated, alienated, alone in the world, His sole remaining possession was his whiteness, the only thing that gave his existence meaning. That was the energy that fueled the massacre in Charleston, South Carolina. It now sits like an incubus in the American soul, seething hatred and fear, waiting for more black lives to consume. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.